little water, and constant cold. One slip from the stool, and he would be instantly separated from his testicles and penis. He was familiar with the technique because it was one of his favorites. He had used it against more than a few Iraqis and Syrians, both militants and civilians, over the past decade. One night, after more than a little gin, Landry had used it on a suspected insurgent as the man's wife was forced to watch. When the man refused to admit to any wrongdoing, Landry shoved him off the stool and forced his wife to watch him bleed out. It was later determined that he'd been snatched from the wrong house. Landry had murdered an innocent man, radicalizing his wife in the process and ensuring their children would become the next generation of determined jihadis.
"It's just you and me, Landry. No soft Western interrogation room, no water and temperature fluctuations, no Americans, no supervisors, no doctors, no CIA. No rules."
Landry's eyes darted around the room as he struggled for balance.
"I don't have to tell you how this could end, Landry. I need you to tell me everything there is to know about General Qusim Yedid. Where he lives, how you contact him, security, everything. Or I'm going to turn you into a woman."
"Mo, please don't do this. I'll draw you a map. I'll take you there myself. I'll do anything. I've got money, Mo. Lots of money that the Russian gave me. We can go to Switzerland. I'll give you all of it. It's enough money to disappear on Mo, and it will all be yours. Yedid lives in Athens, but spends a lot of time on a boat in the Med. He's still brokering jobs."
"Why didn't you tell us any of this back in the official interrogation cell?"
Landry stayed silent, focusing on his balance. Apparently he was more afraid of Yedid than he was of years of incessant gang rape in prison.
"What kind of jobs?" Mo continued, after he'd given Landry enough time to think.
"Whatever someone needs, kidnapping, hits, car bombs, you name it."
"Like sending my old unit to..."
Redacted.
"To attack a CIA compound?"
Landry's mouth went dry.
"Yeah."
"Tell me more."
"There are Syrian refugees in every city in Europe, former fighters, and General Yedid has connections to all of them."
"What's the next target?"
"I honestly don't know, Mo, I swear to God. Gray asked to be put in touch with him, and I told him where to find him."
"Why would Gray want to do that, Landry?"
"I don't know. I figured it was none of my business,"
Landry squeaked as he caught his balance.
"Take an educated guess for me."
"It's got to have something to do with the Russian."
"The one in Switzerland?"
"Yeah, that's him. He and Gray have got to be behind all of this. I'm just a small part. I'm a nobody."
"Oh, I know that, Landry. What was the last thing Gray asked of you before he took over comms with Yedid?"
"He asked me to have General Yedid track down a sniper."
Sweat poured from the former CIA man as he did everything he could to steady his quivering legs on the shaky stool.
"A sniper?"
"Yeah, the best in Syria."
"Who is that?"
"I don't know, exactly. They call him the Shishani. It means, like, day shooter or day Chechen or something. Red beard. That's all I know, I swear to you, Mo. I'd tell you if I knew anything else. Please cut me down."
Mo took notes as Landry continued to talk, wobbling on the decrepit stool, almost losing his balance, and begging for Mo to cut the wire that encircled his manhood. He explained details of the operation, providing descriptions of those involved along with dead drop locations and security practices. Landry was becoming increasingly helpful the longer he balanced. Mo left the room, walking outside to make a phone call, leaving Landry trembling on the stool.
"I'll be back. Don't go anywhere."
"Mo, Mo, don't leave me here."
Mo dialed Reese's number and conveyed the new information from Landry. Minutes later, the analysts at the CIA were adding Landry's information to the growing target package they were putting together on one General Qusim Yedid. Mo ended the call and walked back into the room where Landry's muscular and tattooed physique was perched on the tiny stool like a circus elephant.
"Please, please,"
Landry pleaded, looking into the deep, dark, unforgiving eyes of his former asset.
"I've told you everything I know."
"I believe you,"
Moe stated, before quickly kicking the stool across the room and sending Jules Landry straight to the ground. All 215 pounds of him hit the gravel-strewn concrete floor with a brutal thud, less a few ounces of tissue that hung for a moment on the wrong side of the piano wire until landing beside his body. An animalistic scream followed. With his hands secured behind his back, Landry could do nothing to stop the massive bleeding from what was left of his groin. As the bright red arterial blood pulsed out in spurts, the volume of his screams decreased, eventually becoming a mere groan. He lost consciousness within a minute and was clinically dead before Moe had his truck in drive. Part 3. Redemption. Chapter 70. Washington, D.C., October. What began as a calculated late-night leak to select reporters was confirmed as true by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence the following day. The cable news channels devoted all their coverage to the story, and even the networks preempted their daytime broadcasts. Terrorism, it seemed, trumped both soap operas and Judge Judy. U.S. and European intelligence agencies had identified a former Iraqi major from the Ministry of Interior, Mohammed Farouk, as the mastermind behind the recent terrorist attacks across Europe. Farouk had served as a cell leader for Amin Nawaz, using his skills as a trained special operations commander against both civilian and military targets. Farouk had slipped through the net that had led to Nawaz's death by Albanian commandos and was believed to be on the run somewhere in Turkey. A dated, pixelated image of Farouk was broadcast to an international audience, giving terror a face. The United States would supply Allied intelligence and law enforcement agencies with both assets, including classified biometric information that would aid in his capture. What Allied intelligence services did not know was that the human and signals intelligence provided by the United States would be intentionally misleading, and that the biometric data, facial recognition, fingerprint, and voice recognition, did not match Farouk's. Within hours, Moe was the most wanted man in the world. He had instant cover for status with any Islamic terrorist organization on the globe. Chapter 71. Odessa, Ukraine, October. One of Andreyanov's security detail could certainly have completed the task, but Gray insisted upon doing it himself. He'd been kept mostly behind a desk for his entire career and would suffer that fate no longer. He would be out in the field where the action was. He would prove himself to his Russian master. Andreyanov's contact had arranged the safe house, which was a simple but clean apartment on Khretska Street. Its location put him near the Philharmonic Society and the Museum of Art, in addition to numerous bars and restaurants. Nearly everyone here spoke Russian, in addition to the national language, which gave him ample opportunity to improve his latent skills. It didn't take much cash to get him access to the docks, euros being the local preference. Andreyanov had provided him with enough currency to bribe half of Ukraine, which made the tiny favor of parking a certain ship at a specific berth quite simple. He was shown where the ship would be tied, and he walked down to the exact site to inspect it himself. It took a few minutes for the GPS unit to locate a sufficient number of satellites to obtain the accuracy that this mission required. This was not a consumer handheld GPS, but a large dual-frequency Omnistar-capable commercial unit designed for mapping and surveying. While a consumer GPS was accurate to within a few meters, This system provided both horizontal and elevation information within 5 to 10 centimeters. So long as the ship was moored as directed and the container placed in the proper position, the assassins would be within range of their target. That evening, Gray carefully recorded the distance and elevation information onto a spreadsheet and printed it along with digital photographs that he'd taken from various vantage points at both the firing and target positions. Everything was checked and triple-checked before he sealed the documents into a DHL Express envelope. He was not going to let this operation be compromised by electronic communications. The information would be in Turkey in 2 days, and his contact there would deliver it personally to the farmhouse. Gray was about to change the world. Chapter 72, Washington, D.C., October. All Reese and Freddy could do now was wait. Wait for the CIA analysts to build a target package on General Qasim Yadid and wait for Rodriguez to get approvals to detain him. Freddy rented a car and made the 8-hour drive to Beaufort, South Carolina, to spend a day with his family. It was Sam's birthday, and he had missed too many of them already. Reese had turned on the TV as he got ready for a workout when he heard a familiar voice. Turning his attention to the screen, he saw Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Katie Buranek on Fox News Sunday talking about unwarranted surveillance. She is right down the street. After his last disastrous attempt, he decided that now was not the time to surprise her with the news that he was alive over the phone. But knowing she was just a few miles down the road at Fox's D.C. bureau, he was having second thoughts. He grabbed his phone from the nightstand and stared at the display. Should I try this again? What do I even say? Hi, Katie, it's Reese. I'm not dead, and I knew that detonator wasn't going to blow your head off last time I saw you. Want to meet up for dinner? Shit! He tossed the phone on the bed, trying to focus on what she was saying in the interview. Should I surprise her at the station? He could be there in minutes. Reese looked at his Resco watch. Yes, that's it. In person would be way better than a phone call. He quickly changed back into his best clothes and headed for the lobby. Reese had his taxi drop him off at a Starbucks catty-corner to the Fox News DC bureau, located just north of the Capitol and surrounded by America's traditional institutions of power. Reese had always liked DC, even though he wasn't a city guy by any means. DC was different. There was an energy in the air. There was a sense that, no matter how bad things were, this was still the United States. This constitutional republic had weathered storms that would have destroyed most nations and had prevailed. As Reese ordered a venti blonde roast and asked that the barista leave room for honey and cream, he couldn't help but think that not long ago, all these instruments of federal power had been focused on finding and killing him. He exited onto E Street Northwest and found his way to North Capitol Northwest. Reese strolled toward the parking lot across the street from the cable news giant, pretending to look at his phone while he observed the front of the building. Fox News Sunday should be finishing up any minute. Wonder how long she stays after taping. What are you doing, Reese? You are going to scare the living daylights out of her if you surprise her. What if she doesn't want to see you? What if she leaves by a different door? Is this going to creep her out? You are overthinking this, Reese. His thoughts were broken by the sight of Katie's blonde ponytail swinging behind her as she exited the building and walked toward the parking lot where Reese waited. There was no mistaking her, even at 200 yards. As he stepped toward her, he felt his phone vibrate. Not many people had this number, so he resisted the urge not to answer it. A number with the local 703 area code was displayed on the LCD screen, and he swiped the icon to answer the call. Yeah? Reese, it's Vic. Where are you now? I'm in D.C., getting a cup of coffee. The hotel coffee not good enough? Well, they didn't have honey, Reese said, frozen in his tracks, watching Katie take a left on Capitol and walk north away from the parking lot.
Okay, well, I need you on a plane ASAP. We have actionable intel, we have approvals, and we are moving resources to respond. Can you be at Dulles in 30 minutes?
I'll be there, Reese said without hesitation.
Better yet, I'll have an agency car pick you up at the hotel. Get back there, grab your stuff, and meet the car out front.
Reese ended the call.
Shit.
He took one last look at Katie as she walked away before jogging toward the street to flag down a ride. Chapter 73, Virginia Beach, Virginia, October. The pagers had gone off at 11:42 a.m. on Sunday, catching what appeared to be ordinary families in the middle of the most mundane of Sunday morning tasks: church services, mowing the lawn, playing with kids. Many of those without wives and children, and a few with, were nursing hangovers from a late night out in a series of Virginia Beach bars. To the untrained eye, this group could be mistaken for a rugby team. Upon closer examination, a few dead giveaways betrayed them as anything but normal, least of which were the odd-looking cigarette pack-sized pagers that were never more than an arm's length away. Though most people had turned in their pagers for mobile phones in the mid-1990s, a few elite special operations units still used them as a secure way to connect via satellite with a very select group of lethal men, always on standby for an emergency just such as this. 45 minutes later, they had assembled in the team room of the most exclusive club on Earth. There would be no more contact with families, friends, or loved ones. The sole focus was now the mission. The families whose lives had once again been interrupted by the now familiar buzz of the Iridium pagers were acutely aware that this might be the last time they saw their husbands and fathers off to work. They shared them with a larger and oftentimes more demanding family, that of the Naval Special Warfare Development Group.
"Team leaders, do we have everyone?"
called out Master Chief Pete Millman in a commanding tone to silence the small talk.
"One's up. Two's up.
Three's up.
Four's up.
Roger. Okay, guys,"
Pete continued, looking around the huge table, flanked on either side by individual desks, adorned with computers connected to a net even more secretive and secure than the SIPR computers usually found in military briefing rooms. Pete was all business, and he suppressed an urge to smile, looking out at the assaulters and team leaders, redacted. This was likely to be one of his last times briefing the guys as their troop chief. He'd been around for a long time, graduating the redacted in the first post-9/11 class, and he'd been deploying ever since. His body had taken more abuse than an NFL lineman over the years, and though he hated the thought, he had a GS position in the operations shop that would start up next year. His first marriage had ended in disaster, before kids had entered the picture. His second marriage was to the command, and he couldn't quite bring himself to separate from her, even after 23 years in the Navy.
"Quick turnaround on this one, gentlemen. The NSC just greenlighted the
redacted
package to capture a Syrian general, one Qusim Yadid, on a yacht in the Med between Libya and Malta. He's not someone on our HVI or war criminal top 10, but he just moved up to the number one spot. The agency has him pegged as a key player in a plan that's already in motion and a direct threat to the United States. This is time-sensitive and has visibility at the highest levels.
Yeah, Smitty,"
Pete said, acknowledging his newest team leader.
"Direct threat? As in we need to exploit him for additional information?"
"That's right. This is a capture-kill mission, not a kill-capture. It was stressed to me in no uncertain terms that we need to take Yadid alive. The intel folks are putting the final touches on the target package, which will include a list of questions to which we need specific answers. Everyone will have a photo of the target and the list of questions."
"How rough can we get with this guy, Master Chief?"
"Don't get excited, Smitty. We are also jumping in an interrogator from Langley, Dr. Rob Bellinger, who will